Welcome to the Ugly Things Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Stacks, the editor and publisher of Ugly Things magazine for the past 40 years. During that time, I've conducted hundreds of interviews, many of them, at least from the early years, on cassette tape. In this episode, we're visiting that tape archive again for an interview I did almost 30 years ago with Johnny Ramone. If you're listening to this podcast, in fact, if you have a pulse and a functioning brain, Johnny Ramone should need no introduction. He was the guitar player and a founding member of the Ramones, a band loved and appreciated by anyone with a pulse and a functioning brain. Here's how the interview came about. Halloween weekend of 1994, I was in New Jersey, hanging out with Jerry Only of the Misfits at the Chiller Theater Convention. Johnny was a big collector of vintage movie memorabilia, and he was also in attendance, so I took the opportunity to introduce myself, and I slipped him a couple of issues of Ugly Things. I figured that was the end of it, but a couple of weeks later, he sent me a postcard from Brazil, thanking me for the magazines and telling me how much he enjoyed them. "Have you ever done a feature on the Vagrants?" he wrote. "I saw them dozens of times while growing up." That sounded like a great angle for a story, so I mailed a letter to Johnny with my phone numbers to see if he'd like to talk about it. Almost immediately, I got a call at work. "Johnny Ramone for you on line two." "Sure," he told me. He'd love to talk about the Vagrants, the Ramones, and anything else I'd like to cover. Even his 60s high school garage band with Tommy Ramone, the Tangerine Puppets. We did a phone interview a few days later, January 3rd, 1995, and that's what you'll be hearing next. First, though, I wanted to encourage anyone listening to become a Patreon supporter. For a small monthly donation, you'll get access to all kinds of exclusive content, including rare photos, music and memorabilia, and interview outtakes. And you'll help us to cover our expenses so we can keep bringing you more unique interviews and discussions. If you join now, you'll get full access to all of the bonus content for the two seasons of the podcast. Just go to patreon.com/uglythingspod. Your support would be very much appreciated. Now here's my 1995 conversation with the late, great Johnny Ramone. It originally appeared in issue number 14 of the magazine.
Okay. First, I thought maybe we could just sort of set the scene a little bit.
Okay.
You growing up in the Forest Hills area of Queens?
Yeah.
Well, what,
basically, you know, our teenage years, yeah.
No, you know, how would you describe your neighborhood? You know, what kind of area is that?
Basically, it was middle class to upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, regular suburb, you know, about 10 miles out of the city.
Yeah. And, you know, when did you first get interested in music?
Well, probably when I was about 6 years old or so, and I saw Elvis Presley on TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you remember what show it was?
It must have been the Ed Sullivan Show, probably, at that point. I mean, I might have saw them. This is Steve Allen, too, and Milton Berle, but I'm not sure. I remember the Ed Sullivan Show.
You don't remember what song he was doing or anything, do you?
You know, and I remember, you know, being really impressed, you know. It's tremendous, and my parents would hate it, and I realized I had to be really good if my parents hated it. And I'd collect a lot of records, even though at that age, because my father had a bar, and they would come in and change the jukebox stuff all the time, and I'd always be hanging out in the bar all the time, and they'd be giving me maybe the 45s out of the jukebox.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty much from the time I was like maybe 8 years old.
Wow, so you already started collecting stuff.
Yeah, I was hanging on the ball all day and watching the ball games and, you know, and collecting all the records, you know, I'd have all those little Richard records on specialty label and whatever was coming out from pretty much like 57 to 60.
That's wow.
Period, you know. I would notice that my parents would get most upset when I put Little Richard records on, so I figured he had to be really good, you know? They'd go nuts, you know?
Yeah.
But, I remember that later on, you know, that any band that, you know, you put them on and your parents would really hate them, they must be good, you know? You know, later on in life, I'd put Black Sabbath on, they would hate that, you know?
If they liked it, then you'd know that you'd be
I always wondered about the Beatles, because, you know, I put that on, like, oh, that's nice, you know? I always know, it can't be as good as the Rolling Stones, you know, because... But somehow they must have transcended that or something, I don't know.
Now, what about, you know, what first actually got you interested in playing the guitar?
In high school, that's when you had mentioned that, you know, the band before.
Yeah.
The Tangerine Purple thing. I guess I was about 16, and I guess when I first started becoming fans of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, so back in 64, bought a guitar, didn't know how to play it at all. Then a couple of friends was starting a band, and I thought the best way to maybe get into the band would be if I just brought a bass guitar, and they would just sort of like to teach me how to play the song.
Yeah.
And I basically did that for about 3-4 months.
What kind of stuff were you doing?
Well, of course you're doing cover songs at that point.
Yeah.
Being 64, 65, 65, that. Rolling Stones, I remember doing Shadows of Night while I was Gloria, I guess it was them that put it out first, but I think we were like sort of covering Shadows of Night one, I think.
Yeah.
What year was that, do you know?
Shadows of Night one was 65.
65?
Late 65, I think.
Okay. Probably, you know, a couple of Bo Brummel's hits that were around at the time, I think. I don't know if that was around that period.
That'd be right, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was when you were still playing bass there?
Yeah, it was very brief. It was very, very brief. I told you that we played at the school gymnasium, not the gymnasium, the auditorium, and we played, and there was a bunch of different bands that were recording acts, and we were just the local thing that went on first. And I saw the Knickerbockers, and they were the headliners, I believe, and I just thought they were just tremendous, and this... You know, I would never be able to play like this. I must just forget this and just give up. So, I just basically just gave up, you know, gave it up at that point. Really, you know, I figured get back to reality and just try to do my best and get a job or something. You know?
That impressed you so much about the Knickerbockers?
Well, they were all able to switch off. They all sang, and they were doing, you know, they did Lies, and I think they did some Beatles songs, and they did a Righteous Brothers song, and I just couldn't believe how they cover these songs, you know, and it just made me feel like I had really no talent towards this at all, you know. Pretty much stopped at that point, and then not until 74 did it start again. So it was already, pretty much without any guitar or doing anything for about eight, nine years.
So now, the Tangerine Puppets, you were playing bass.
Right.
Tommy
was in the band playing guitar.
Oh, Tommy played guitar.
Right, Tommy was a guitarist. He was never a drummer.
Oh, that's right. He learned to play drums to be in the Ramones, didn't he?
Yeah, we pressured him for about a month or so, and then finally talked him into doing it.
How was he as a guitarist?
He was competent, you know. I mean, you know, like a regular guitar player.
Uh-huh. And did you have a lead singer?
We had a lead singer. It was bad. I mean, it was just... I try not to even talk about it, because it's bad.
Well, you know, everyone goes through the bad first bands, you know, but... What other bands were there in your school? I mean, there must have probably been several. Do you remember?
Yeah, I don't remember their names, but the main thing that was around the time was the Vagrants.
Okay.
And they were in Forest Hills. And I knew, well, first I knew Roger Mansour, who was the drummer. And me and him used to be friends. He used to call for me in the morning. We used to go to school. And he was a great drummer. And then I hear, you know, he was telling me how he's going to get into the Vagrants. And Larry West, which is was Weinstein, Larry Weinstein, which is Leslie's brother.
Uh-huh.
You familiar with the
yeah, the band? He was the bass player, right?
Right. And he'd be sitting there in the study hall. He'd be just on permanent suspension for having his hair too long. And he'd be saying how he's starting a band with his brother. His brother's a great guitar player. And I'd ask other kids in the school about, you know, the other good guitar players. And they go, ah, no, he's just a fat kid, you know. He can't, you know, he's not so good. And, you know, but Larry would always be saying how great his brother was. His brother was just a dropout.
You know? Uh-huh. His brother was older, right? Then.
Yeah, his brother was older. So Larry at this point is like 15. I'd be about 16. I think Leslie was like 18. You know? And Larry just got suspended like the whole year because all that mattered was the Vagrants and growing his hair. And, you know, that was the important thing in his life. And so they were starting, and as soon as I saw Leslie play, I thought, wow, this guy's great. You know, he didn't play like he played like later on, but he was just able to play whatever cover he would be doing. He'd be able to do it so exact, you know, Beatles stuff, from Beatles stuff to You Really Got Me, and, you know, that, you know, whatever he would figure out, he would, you know, play just like the record, you know.
Wow. And this is well before they started putting out their own singles, right? The Vagrants, that is.
Right. When did the first one, I Can't Make a Friend, come out?
I think it's
January 66?
Yeah, it's early 66.
Yeah, so this got to be in 65.
So at that point, were they kind of different? They were more diverse, because then they sort of became more like a Young Rascals kind of style.
Right. They went through so many different evolutions throughout the band. I mean, it would start off as a straight cover band, just doing very straight covers, from Beatles to Rolling Stones to... Leslie would get to sing one song, Roll of Beethoven.
Uh-huh.
And they would just switch off on the vocals between Larry and Keith Sabatino, who's the singer.
And did they have the organ all the time?
Yeah, they had the organ. Would it just be a portable one at that point, like a Farfisa?
Yeah.
You know, and then eventually turned into the Hammond. Somewhere along the way, they went away for the summer and to Long Island to play some places. And I think they came back, and that's when you started hearing about the Rascals, the Vanilla Fudge. The Vagrants came back, and they were different. Now they were into more like the Rascal type Vanilla Fudge thing.
Yeah.
With the song slowed down and doing sort of a soul type of thing.
Right.
Like Mustang Sally type stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Good Love. And they were doing Good Love and all, you know. And they kept doing covers of other people's songs, but they would be better than the Rascals and better than the Vanilla Fudge.
Wow.
You know, at doing the stuff. They just looked better. Leslie's guitar playing was far superior to, you know, Gene Martell or something like that.
The drummer for the Vagrants was supposed to be real flashy and like kind of
right.
Like the drummer for the Rascals.
Roger Mansour, yeah, he was great, and but Larry West was really becoming a star at that point. You know. It's weird because they would play, I think, the Rolling Stone Club here in the city. And I think they played there for like six straight months, like five, six nights a week.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, now where was
covers,
the
you know?
Where was the Rolling Stone Club? I don't think I've heard about that one.
I think it was Midtown on the east side. Once I got out of certain areas, it was difficult for me. I don't know if I was 18, I might have been 17 still or something. So it might have been difficult to get into certain places.
Now, where would you usually see them play? What kind of places?
I would try to get into wherever I could. It'd be, you know, strange things. I mean, sometimes you get into certain clubs that wouldn't be so heavy with the proofing. There would be a place in the city. I saw them at Manhattan Center. It's hard to remember. Action House on Long Island. Places like that.
So were you driving at this point?
No,
to the show?
I never drove until just much later.
Okay. So you get a ride with a friend or take the train or whatever?
Yeah, that's how you'd be doing it, get a ride with friends.
Yeah. So generally at these shows, would there be like a bill of several bands or with the Vagrants?
No, later on it got that way. We're probably looking at around 67. You'd go to the shows a lot at the Fillmore.
Uh-huh.
And the Fillmore would have these multiple group shows. And Vagrants would be getting on shows like that on maybe the lower bill. I remember going to a WMCIA Good Guys show here in the city, which had a whole bunch of acts. Everybody would come on and play about three songs. And the Vagrants had a fairly good bill on that. The Cream were on it, The Who were on it, Mitch Ryder, Detroit Wheels, not the Detroit Wheels, Mitch Ryder, when he went solo at that point, was, I think, the headliner.
Wow. Must have been a phenomenal show.
Yeah, these things were really good, you know.
And how did the Vagrants match up to you? Do you think they matched up to the...
Yeah, I thought they matched up, yeah.
That's great.
I didn't see no problem, you know. They had a certain... the band looked so good. And I said Larry was really, he was becoming like a Jim Morrison. And it's hard to imagine, but he must have been modeling himself after Jim Morrison at that point, you know. Just, you know, permanently like fucked up and, you know, with the leather pants and the long, you know, wavy curly hair.
Uh-huh.
You know.
So, you know, what would the stage act be like? Would there be a lot of movement, or would they...
Yeah, a lot of movement. Leslie became more and more flashy with the outfits he would be getting on to. You know, they would just go through so many different phases, but everything would come in, you know, with the really loud colored clothes, with boas. Leslie would be wearing these boas, studded things around him and everything.
Wow. So did they have like...
Weird seeing some 350-pound guy like this, you know.
So were you like part of like a Vagrant's following that used to sort of follow him around, or was there not really a following? It was just, I don't know, different people every show.
I was just a fan like anybody's a fan. I would really not be bothered talking to people. I would just go with my friends and watch the show, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be going to all concerts. I'd be trying to see all the concerts I could, and let's see, I saw the Stones like 5 times with Brian Jones. I mean, I've seen The Who 10 times, and The Doors probably 7-8 times. Just every band. I don't know if there's anybody that I had wanted that I didn't see.
Wow. Well, can you remember any particular standout shows? I mean, what about the first time you saw the Stones? That must have been...
First time I saw the Stones was in June of 64.
So it's the first tour.
At Carnegie Hall. And then I saw them later on in the year, I think at the Academy of Music, which later became the Palladium on 14th Street in the city. The following year, again, at the Academy of Music. And then probably the following year after that at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. That was tremendous. But I'll tell you, you know, as you become a little bit more educated within going to concerts, I mean, that's basically, that was the second concert I had ever been to, seeing the Rolling Stones. Later on, after you've seen hundreds of concerts, and then you start seeing some stuff, then you sort of have like a better grasp on the situation. Seeing Led Zeppelin at the time of first album was out, and they started introducing a whole lot of love, so they were getting ready to do a second album where they had done it and weren't playing the stuff yet. So
yeah,
it was in between first, second album time, and saw them at the Pavilion in Queens, and I was like, right in the front against the stage, and that was just tremendous. You know, the certain excitement that you felt that you only feel it very rarely.
Right.
You know, you feel like the hair on your arms like standing up. You know, seeing Grand Funk Railroad was tremendous. I saw them at Stony Brook Gym, and it must have been 120 degrees or something in the place because you're just dripping wet without doing anything. And the volume that they played at, they were tremendous. Some of the great shows. Seeing the Doors, great show.
Yeah, when was that, 67?
Yeah, but I've seen them a bunch of times, but probably the last time I saw them, it was the most memorable one. It was at the Singer Bowl.
Uh-huh.
I think a sort of famous concert because a whole riot broke out. I've seen clips from that with a girl in the dressing room all full of blood and all.
Yeah, yeah.
Our manager that we have now was the promoter of the concert. And he was a kid living across the street from me, and now a passive recrossed, and he's been our manager for the last 12 years.
Now, what's your manager's name?
Gary Kerfurst.
Okay.
And he was promoting these shows at the Singer Bowl. And he told me how, oversold the place by like 5,000 people. Fans were getting flat deals. He was like 18 years old doing this. And he says, the Doors wouldn't go on. The place is overcrowded. And I go back there to see, tell him you got to get on already. And Jim Morrison just wouldn't even look at me, acknowledge me. And I'm trying to tell him, it's time to go on. so he goes on and he just lays on the floor for a while. And then gets up and starts asking people, does anybody have a cigarette? And everybody starts throwing the cigarettes. Then he starts some chant about the pigs in the place and fuck the pigs. And he's getting everyone chanting this. And he starts something about throw your chairs or something. And as a whole riot broke out, everybody throwing their chairs. And I'm on the frontier on this. I think I'm just trying to get out of here. And I guess he was just trying to take it as far as he could take it,
Wow.
With this, the crowd manipulation.
Now, what do your parents think about all this? Was this affecting your lifestyle at all? And,
at home?
Yeah.
At that point?
Yeah.
I'm sure that I was not becoming what they had hoped at that point.
Yeah. When did you start growing your hair long and that kind of thing?
I would start giving them problems about it pretty much immediately after I would see the, early 64 from the time the Beatles and the Rolling Stones came out.
Uh-huh.
I kept trying to do my best, and be rebellious at that point.
Right. Was the school really tough? Were the rules about stuff like that?
At that point, as far as any sort of dress code and your hair.
Right.
You would just sit there, like I was saying about Larry from... the vagrant, you could just sit there suspended, if that's what you chose, I really couldn't do that.
Yeah, right. Now, at that point, when you were in high school, was Tommy the only other Ramon that you associated with?
Yeah, at that point, yeah. I met Dee Dee after high school. I met Joey after high school.
Okay.
Soon after.
As far as other bands, did you ever see the Stooges or the MC5?
Oh, yeah, a lot of times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, what do you remember about those shows?
I'm going to a Halloween show on Staten Island, and MC5 went on before the Stooges on that particular show, and then the Stooges went on, I remember somebody throwing an egg at Iggy, and he stopped playing. And he went off after four songs. I was very surprised because, I wouldn't think that an egg would really seem to bother him.
Yeah.
It would bother me, but I didn't think it would bother him.
Yeah.
Because he'd rub all this crap all over him all the time, you know, but they left after four songs. And they, at that point, they were doing Loose, TVI, the Funhouse album.
Wow.
So I saw them at that point. I saw them a couple of times at Electric Circus, that's what it's called, right at St. Mark's Place in the city. Again, at Pavilion in Queens, too. It was another show with them in the MC5.
What were the MC5 like?
Really good, but I saw something better in the Stooges. I really like MC5, so I don't want to say anything negative, but it just seemed like, I don't know if I ever really saw them at their peak. You probably would have seen them in Detroit or something like that at their peak in the early days.
Yeah.
But it just seemed like, Michigan, it just didn't seem like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, like a greaser type of thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't really, really, really cool. Like, when you're from New York, everyone else seems a little bit, a bit of a hick.
Yeah.
And I got that feeling, and somehow the Stooges somehow transcended that. It was just so sick, the whole show, that, you know, it went past that.
Right, yeah.
You look at bands as being, not anymore, but at that point, you look at bands as being cool. Who was cool, you know?
Right. Now, how did you look upon the English bands? I mean, was that were they at a disadvantage or an advantage as far as that sort of cool image went?
Well, what do you mean, Led Zeppelin?
Well, yeah, you know, the Stones or the Who or whatever, you know.
No, those bands always seemed really cool.
Yeah.
You know.
You
know, English bands, I mean, I hate to feel it, but they always had this mystique because they were from the other side. You know, and I would always want to defend American bands and all, but, you know, of course, I was, you know, a big fan of the Who, and they were one of the best live bands I've ever seen.
Right.
You know, I mean, still, there's nothing out that compares to the Who. There's nothing out now that compares to the Who. There's been nothing out for pretty much the whole time, I feel, as a live band that can really compete with them. I mean, since I've been the Ramones, I mean, the early Clash were really good. But I don't see nothing actually compares with the Who.
Right. Now, the first time you saw the Who, was that on their first tour in 67?
Probably, yeah. Probably. I think that was probably at the WMCA Good Guys show. That's probably the first time over.
Did they smash that stuff and everything?
Yeah. Yeah, they'd come on to three songs. I think they were doing Substitute and Can't Explain to My Generation and smash the stuff up.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that must have been amazing then. You got Pete Townsend to be on your last record then.
At this point,
this seems like a different person, almost.
Yeah, it's totally different. It's no longer the same excitement. It's no big deal to me. I meet any of these people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, never at this point. It's always such a disappointment generally in meeting people that you wanted to meet all your life, you know.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. I don't know if you remember, but on that first two tour, I think the Blues Magoos opened. Did you ever see that?
I saw Blues Magoos a lot of times.
And what did you think of that?
I used to go to Café Voix.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Right, and I think it would be, it'd be like $1 to get in the afternoons and like $2 or $3, $2 probably at night, probably $3 on the weekend. And I remember seeing the Love and Spoonful trying out.
Oh, really?
The job. And I'd go there like every week. I'd come into the city, take the subway in with my friend, go down there, see the Blues Magoos, Love and Spoonful. Love and Spoonful were the best. The Magicians were really good.
Right, yeah.
Later on, the guy wrote a couple of songs. I think the Turtles covered and became number one hits.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And, I don't know if they were doing the songs in the set or what, that they ended up writing for the Turtles, I don't know. But, you know, they were doing Invitation to Cry and all that.
That's a great
song.
The guy
had a tremendous voice, and they're a really good band.
What about the Middle Class? Do you remember them?
No.
I think they were maybe from Long Island. You must have seen the Blues Project, I assume.
Blues Project, I saw the Blues Project, yeah.
Did you ever see the Velvet Underground?
No, I never had no interest. Somehow I must have heard the record. I felt that they were just totally incompetent. And never saw nothing in them. Later on, when I started, when we started playing, I started people going. I read a review saying, "Oh, Velvet Underground influenced," and I thought, I never even listened to this band. How are we influenced by them? So I put the records on, and then I started seeing what was good. They did have some good songs, but the playing was always very incompetent.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, we grew up with listening to the great guitarists, Page and Beck and Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton, and then all of a sudden you start hearing that stuff, and it's different now.
Yeah, it's a different approach. Yeah.
Now that you've gotten used to hearing punk rock and hearing some bands that don't play very competently as it is,
yeah.
You go back and you listen to the Underground, it all sounds like something that's happening right now.
Yeah, all right.
So,
now, you must have seen Hendrix too, right?
Yeah, I saw Hendrix at Steve Paul Fiend. I didn't see him before that, even too. Steve Paul Fiend at the time was like a 200-seat club.
Wow.
And just sat on the floor, and there was like a 6-inch stage, and sat on the floor right in front of him.
Was this before he went to England?
This right when he came back, and first album was just had just come out.
Uh-huh.
Still not much demand yet at that point. I guess it all escalated really quick, though.
Right.
But I saw him prior to that at, I got confused here, because they were at the Cafe Watt, the London School for the Night Owl, that was what the place was called.
Okay.
It was the Night Owl, so, those are good, all those bands at the Night Owl. Cafe Watt, I didn't go there very often. The Cafe Watt, because it was sort of a more of a kid's place compared to the Night Owl. So Night Owl was always a cooler, hipper place.
So Cafe Watt was like...
Cafe Watt was more of a thing that kids went to on Saturday afternoons or something.
Teen dance kind of thing?
Yeah, it wasn't dance. It was still a village beating a club, but it was still for the younger kids.
Okay.
And I saw Hendrix there, and it was Jimmy James and the Blue Flames.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I didn't pay much attention to this at all at the time. Because the only thing I remember was that Randy California was in the band, and I knew Randy California, who was in. He was living in Forest Hills.
Now, you said, now what got you back into playing again?
So that would have been 74. I got laid off my job. I was working as a construction worker. And I just thought that while being laid off until my father could find me another job, that I'd buy a guitar and just fool around with Dee Dee and we'd just start something and just have some fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started like that, and then we decided to just ask two other friends to be in the band. And we would just start switching off to figure out who should be playing what. Me and Dee Dee were both playing guitar, and then after a little while I said, forget it, Dee Dee, it's hard enough to tune one guitar, I can't tune two guitars. And he kept putting his guitar to tune all the time, so I figured you better go switch to bass.
Uh-huh.
You know. And Dee Dee would be singing, and we had a friend trying to teach him how to play bass, and he couldn't keep up, and Joey was playing drums.
And what kind of stuff were you doing to start off with?
Ramon stuff.
Oh, so that's what you were starting to write?
Yeah, first day.
Wow.
First rehearsal, we put the records on. We said, okay, let's figure out how to play this, you know. We put on, like 1910 Fruit Gum Company or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Something like Indian Giver, which we ended up doing later on. I said, forget it, I can't figure out how to play this. I have no idea, you know. How do you figure out how to play a song? I said, they would put the record on and, hit a few chords. I don't know, I don't hear enough that sounds right. And then just forget that, we didn't write something. So we sat there and we wrote, I Don't Want to Get Involved With You, which we never did record. We recorded it for a demo. And then we wrote, I Don't Want to Walk Around With You. And every day we'd sit there and write stuff.
Wow. Well, it seemed like you definitely had a knack for writing like catchy pop songs. It must have been. I mean, what were your influences as far as songwriting? Is it just something that you must have absorbed? I mean, you weren't really conscious of.
Yeah, you can probably hear the influences with whatever particular song.
Yeah.
No real one thing. It was pretty much I mean, we were liking everything, you know. I mean, we grew up with liking bubblegum music. We always looked at the Beatles as the best band. And I still feel that they're the best band. I don't think anybody's even close.
Now, did you see them live?
Yeah.
Oh, what did you think of them live?
Stadium. I couldn't hear anything.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was shit.
Any live stuff I've heard has just been tremendous, though. I mean, they play, and the singing and the playing is exactly like the record.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's a myth that they couldn't play live because of the Hollywood Bowl album, they sound great, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing because they have no monitors. They're screaming constantly over everything, playing with no monitors. The singing's all perfect. The harmonies are perfect.
Yeah.
Every album, there's be so many songs, just so many great songs. You know, to be able to put out albums, they must have been putting out about 3 a year at some point, right?
Yeah, yeah. Plus a bunch of singles.
And singles, and then to go and write a double white album, which is, the whole album is still great, and, you know, with, I don't know how many songs are on it, you know, it must be somewhere about 25 songs from a double album.
Yeah.
A tremendous output of material.
Well, yeah, you guys had a pretty tremendous output, too, and, you know, in the first few years, you were putting out a couple albums a year for a while.
Well, yeah, in the beginning, we had everything written already for the first 3 albums. And when we went in to record the first album, pretty much right from the start, I felt that the record company's going to stop picking through our songs if we let them. So we can't let that happen. So let's just record our songs in the order that we wrote them. So I was aware that, you know, a lot of first albums, people come out, they pick their best stuff, and the second album is a bit of a disappointment. It's, you know, it's a drop down off the first album.
That's usually the pattern, yeah. I don't think that was true with you.
And there's usually not much progression. I felt that if we record the first 14 songs that we wrote, that the next 14 songs might be a slight progression. And same with the next 14. So we just felt that if we record them in the order that we had written them, each album, even though we might not get any better musically, that there might be a slight progression in the songwriting.
Right.
And I think that is there. You know,
definitely, yeah.
Of course, by the time of, let's see, Rocket to Russia, Lobotomy, I'm trying to think what's on it, Lobotomy, Sheena, we were not capable of writing that stuff at the time we had written the stuff on the first album.
Right, yeah.
We were still a little more limited.
Yeah, there's definitely a development.
You see, so through pretty much 10 years of going to see bands, and learning, and you learned a lot. I mean, I can feel that a lot of what we've done is just through what I've learned from seeing bands for all those years before.
Right.
Of things that I see bands do that was really good, and bands that would make certain mistakes.
Yeah.
You can learn from that. You can learn from other people's mistakes. I mean, I would just look at these bands and watch them walk on the stage and think, wow, they already blew the excitement already just walking on the stage, you know. You know, they come on and start tuning up and things like that. There was a time when people did that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way you explain it, it sounds like you had a very thought out. I mean, did you consciously think about learning from the mistakes of old bands, or that was just the way it was?
Well, we were doing the best we could do, I mean, as far as the songwriting. I mean, that was what we could do. That was all we could do. As far as the live show, yeah, as it would go along, you would start applying things that, you know, that you had learned from other bands.
Right.
You know, I mean, live, we knew what we were up against. We knew that there were so many great bands, and kids had grown up seeing The Who and Led Zeppelin and seeing these bands, and we felt that we're going to have to come off as confident as we can. There was no punk rock where you could just be incompetent like maybe some bands can be now and no one really cares, and you can get up there and just make noise, and, you know, bands do that.
Yeah.
You know? Have you seen Sonic Youth?
No.
Okay.
But, you know, I know what they sound like.
You know what they sound like.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a period of time where really you could not really, you know, get away with doing that.
Yeah, why?
You know, just kept them making noise for as a solo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we felt we were up against these bands. There was nothing else to go by.
Yeah, well, but you combine that you know, competence with also stripping it down to simplistic as far as keeping the song short and simple and to the point, you know, which is maybe something that I've been missing from music since
late 60s, we had thought that things had gotten away from the songs, but you start off and basically you start off a front. You're not looking to change any sort of music. You know, a year into it, you start realizing what you're doing. You know, that you do have something there, and that, you know, it is different. We were still trying to write songs, and we thought we were writing songs like everyone else was. We didn't really even think that we were writing songs that were so different. All we could sing lyrically were about things that we could relate to. We weren't sitting there trying to write some ridiculous songs or six funny songs. It was just coming out naturally.
Yeah.
You know? We couldn't sing about girls and cars and things like this. We didn't have girlfriends. We didn't have cars. We didn't have this stuff. You know, it wasn't anything that we could relate to, love or anything like that. We were just borderline loonies, you know?
Now, when you
try to cling to our sanity, you know?
When you started the Ramones in 74, I mean, what else was around at that time that you even thought was, that you even respected musically, you know?
Well, I tell you, I've seen the Dolls a lot of times. I saw the Dolls like 50 times. They were always pretty much Rolling Stone type influence, though.
Yeah.
A good, exciting band.
They must have been great, yeah.
It was a lot of fun to watch, and but I could see their shortcomings at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I could see that middle America was not going to relate to this image.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a little too much, you know, to have, you know, especially the cover with a dress like a drag and put lipstick on.
Uh-huh.
You know, Alice Cooper's one thing, but this is something else.
Yeah.
And they were Rolling Stones influenced, you know, it was a little too obvious at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah, especially Johansson.
Yeah, and it seemed like it was another, you know, like a Rolling Stones copy thing, and they were even doing the blues type things that the Rolling Stones had been influenced with at one point, you know? You know, with Pills and things like that.
Yeah, right.
And Slade. We saw Slade, and we realized that the band just sounded tremendous. They were powerful, they had great songs.
Yeah, a lot of great songs.
His voice is tremendous, and they were limited, you know, in their ability, you know? So I felt that, you know, that maybe we could do something, you know, that we could play too, and that, you know.
What about the Dictators? Did you?
No, it was not familiar. We were not familiar with the Dictators. They were happening at the same time as us.
Yeah.
And we weren't really familiar with them, and nobody was mentioning the Dictators to us. Not until a while into it. You know, do you know when the first Dictators album came out?
I think it's 74, but it might be 75, early 75.
We're not aware of the similarities until, you know, much later.
Yeah, it's only on the first album anyway. I think they rapidly sort of became more...
different, I know.
Yeah, you know, more mainstream, I guess.
Right. Well, they try to go that direction. But,
yeah.
Somehow, I don't, they were never playing the same circuit. I don't know where they were, how they got signed. Because we were down at CBGB's, and you had to build up a following, and I don't know where else they just popped up from. you know?
Yeah.
They must have got signed right away somehow, and they were never playing CBGBs. It must have been another area totally, like the Bronx or somewhere or another.
Yeah,
I don't know where they came out of.
I've
known them well since then, but I really never got around to discussing it with them.
Right.
They were managed, I think, by the Blue Oyster Cult people or something like that.
Yeah, I think they sort of got steered in that direction, you know?
Yeah, so they were in another whole different area, Bronx or something, and then they all of a sudden just got signed somehow and all of a sudden had the record out. No one even knew about them as far as New York City went.
Yeah. Now, when you guys started off at CBGBs, did you feel like you were part of some movement, or was that something that was sort of just you were lumped in with some other bands, you know, later on when the journalists got hold of it?
You felt like you were part of a movement that was going on there. Yeah, it was a whole scene. You didn't really feel, we always felt separate from the other bands. There was always a rivalry between all bands, you know, in some way or another. There's some bands we were closer friends with than other bands. There's some bands you'd feel the rivalry from them towards you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We were always friends with Blondie.
Right.
I don't know if I really felt any real, because none of the bands I felt were doing anything at all like us. I really didn't feel any real competition from any of them, except for maybe, say, the Heartbreakers later on.
Yeah, right.
You know, I always looked at them as the next best band.
Right.
In the New York scene.
Were there any bands that you remember back then that you thought should have become known that just sort of disappeared?
Looking back at it, at the time, no. Looking back at it, I see bands that I felt, after seeing certain punk bands become big now, I see, say, the Dead Boys were much better than any of these punk bands I see now.
Yeah.
And they got nowhere at all, you know. Probably sold 5,000 records or something, I don't know, you know. And they were much better than whatever I see. And I look at any of these bands, like Stone Temple Pilots or any of that stuff, you know.
No comparison.
You know, it's like, yeah. So it's like, this band was, I went to the show at CBGB's and saw the Damned and the Dead Boys. And the Damned was the time for, you know, New Rose and Neat, you know, and the Damned went on, and I thought, wow, this is tremendous, you know, great band, you know, Dead Boys went on and were a little bit better than the Damned even, you know?
Well.
And, so.
What, were you friends with the Dead Boys? Did you hang out with
them? Yeah, we were friends with Dead Boys. We were friends with them, and the Cramps were always a good band. They were at CBGB's.
Yeah, right.
In the early days, we'd have them open for us all the time. We always thought they were an unusual act.
Right.
But somehow we were always looked upon as separate, though.
Yeah.
By the band. Somehow, I guess we were, you know, I guess we were put in a separate category.
Well, why do you think that was?
I don't know. I felt like they looked at us as, I guess, the leader, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, with certain feeling that I guess they would have towards us, you know.
Were you surprised when you got signed?
No, I was surprised it took so long.
Really?
I don't know. You know, you start off, you're a little naive about the whole thing. I mean, I started playing. I thought, all right, we'll get a band together. We'll do this for a little while. We'll get a record contract, put a record out, and then go back to working as a construction worker, you know? I'll do this for a year and get a record out so I have a record that I've played on. You know, I didn't realize how hard it was or, you know, you know, so you have a million bands in the world out there, and I didn't think of any of these things at all, you know.
Yeah.
So it was all nice and simple, you know. You just go get some original material, and you'll get signed, and you put a record out. That's it, you know. It just took so hard to so long to do it, and even that we had it relatively easy even with that, you know. From the time where I guess it took 2 years to get the record out, you know. I guess that's not really too bad.
Yeah, well, it must have just seemed like a long time.
You haven't played guitar in your life before, really, you know.
Now, I mean, once you had the first record out, did you foresee, like, continuing to put out records once you had that first one out?
Well, yeah, it took so long, it was so much work already, that I felt like, oh, I better continue doing this.
Well, you already had all those songs stockpiled,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, all these songs stockpiled, yeah. You know, and at some point, still I didn't think about, somewhere on there I started thinking about that maybe we could become big. And especially when the English punk bands started, the movement here, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles of the 70s, you know, the Ramones and the Sex Pistols, you know, and the Clash. That, you know, we'll be, you know, these are the best bands and we'll be the leaders of, you know, of that movement, you know. But it wasn't too big.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you guys kept going anyway.
Yeah.
I don't want to start getting into the whole history of the Ramones, or we'll be talking all night, but just to sort of wrap it up, what music do you listen to now? What do you find yourself listening to and buying and stuff?
Mostly old stuff, still.
Like, what kind of stuff you've been listening to, you know, the last few weeks?
Well, I know this week I put on The Beatles of the BBC. Uh-huh. Gave me that for Christmas. I put that on.
Yeah, I got it too.
Yeah, I thought it'd be nice to edit it down and just make a tape out of it, you know?
Yeah.
Out the songs that that are done well that I never heard before.
Yeah, right.
My own tape.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Get rid of some of the talking and some of the crap. But I was amazed right away in how good they sounded, of course, as live as usual, you know?
Yeah.
Elvis, I always listen to Elvis. I have an old jukebox, so I always put my, you know, I put the jukebox on a lot so I can get a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
You know, I just keep singles in it from prior to 64. Nothing much. I mean, if I'm going to listen to anything current, but if I'm going to listen to anything from the last 20 years, I'm still probably listening to mostly a lot of early punk stuff.
So
I'll put the Dead Boys on still, the Cramps, and things like that.
So you think that stuff still stands up?
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think the best of it does, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of have a hard time imagining that a lot of the stuff coming out now will stand up, you know?
In fact, you know, like before we play in between groups, we you know, make up a tape, and still every other song... you know, I'll lay out like a format. I'll tell them that, you know, every other song, pick the punk rock's greatest hits, and then you put something new by, say, Metallica or the, you know, or somebody, like Nirvana or Soundgarden.
Uh-huh.
But still half the tape will be, every other song will be one of the punk rock's greatest hits.
Yeah, right.
You know, you know, the one or two best songs by, you know, the Buzzcocks and Sham 69 and, you know, the Clash, of course, Sid and Sex Pistols.
Right. Did you get to become pretty good friends with those guys? Because you seem to be one of the few bands that even admit to liking, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, somewhat, you know. We would talk to them. They would come. Sid always wanted to... Sid was a really big fan. And I felt bad when he died. I wish I would have tried to do something to talk to him about it, you know?
Yeah, right. Did you see him at all when he was living in New York and everything?
I would see him, and, you know, if somebody had told me how he wanted to be in the band, and he wanted to, when he heard that we had Tommy left and got Marky in the band,
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how could he be in the band as a drummer, you know? And then all of a sudden when I read that book, I realized he was a drummer. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I knew he played drums early on. I don't know if he could actually play them or not.
So it sounds like it's just, I don't know how true it is, but somebody told me he wanted to be in the band as a drummer. You know, after the change was made. So it's possible. After I heard that he played drums, I didn't even know he had played drums at the time.
That would have been an interesting film. I don't know where that would have gone.
You know, just looking back, I wish I would have talked to him more, you know, but, you know, him and his case, they were a little too stoned all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and pretty, I wasn't into that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I sort of grew out of that as a teenager.
Right, I mean, that must have, you must have seen that out to a lot of people, you know, on the scene, on the punk scene.
I mean, I sort of always looked at it as sort of a job in a way, you know.
Right.
I mean, like, I mean, it's a great job, and, you know, and I kind of wish for more, you know. I mean, I can't believe I've been doing this for 21 years.
Yeah, you're one of the best jobs in the world, being in the Ramones, shit.
How lucky I've been, all the nice people I've met. But, you know, I look at it that I have to perform to the best I can be when I play the show. I don't want to let the fans down. It's really important. They have a certain image to live up to. You know, and I, it'd be very bad to get up there and give them a bad performance because of, you know, self-abuse, you know, because they hear so much about you, you know, you gotta, and you don't want them to say, you were better last time, even though it's going to happen on occasions, you know, you're going to be better last time or better last year or better 5 years ago. But, you know, you're always hoping that they're going to say, you know, this is the best I've seen you, you know.
Yeah, right.
So it's hard to live up to. So somewhere along there you have to stop before, that happens.
Yeah. So, how long do you think it's gonna last? The Ramones. You see you guys being like the Rolling Stones. And...
No, I'd say 99% sure this will be our last album.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? You just think that's all you've got left in you?
I just want to stop before it gets bad.
Yeah.
I know we're still good, and I don't see nobody out there that's better, and I can tell. I watched the videotapes. So, you know, I don't see much difference between now and 10 years ago, really. But
yeah.
But I don't feel bands should be playing like the Rolling Stones. I don't think people should be doing that. They should have a mandatory retirement age. You know, make bands retire after 20 years.
Yeah, it might not be a bad idea, I suppose.
You know, it's sports, you have to get out.
So what do you do when Ramones are over?
I don't know, hope nothing.
You're not the kind of guy that's going to go off and record a singer-songwriter album or nothing.
No. If I can't do anything as good, I know I can't do anything as good as this, and so there's no point in doing it.
Yeah. Will you still have the urge to play music or?
No. I don't think so. You know.
Yeah, from what I read about you, you know, sound like one of those guys that sits around playing guitar 24 hours a day.
I don't think I've played the guitar in my house ever, and since I've been in the band. The only time I touch it is in the dressing room or you know, on the stage or at rehearsal.
Right.
You know?
And how often do you guys rehearse?
When we don't record, we rehearse for an hour before we have to go on tour. You know? We don't really take off for very long, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll be off for 3 weeks. That's usually about tops. So we'll go in and rehearse for an hour, run through the set once the day before we leave, and that's it. We're fine. If you play one show, we're back to, you know, normal.
Right.
You know.
Well,
I could rehearse all week, and I'm still going to play the first show, and the first show isn't going to be quite what I want it to be anyway, so it doesn't make no difference. You know, I have to play. We've played 2,100 shows at this point.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah. After that many, you'll have it down anyway, right?
We have it down. You're still capable of making a mistake on Blitzkrieg Bop on any particular night. I mean, you can still get lost. They become pretty easy. Usually don't mess up that one, but this is something that, you know. Sometimes you just go blank.
Yeah.
You know, you're up there, you just go blank, and when you get panic-stricken, what's the next song? I can't remember what the next song is. Oh, then you forget, what song am I doing right now? You know? It's like a weird feeling.
Yeah, I play too, so I know the thing. I wrote this song, how come I don't know how to play it that way?
Oh, yeah. You know? You know, I'll hear him counting off, going, you're getting ready to go 1, 2, 3, 4, and I go, what? I don't know what the next song is. You know? And I just watch where he's putting his hands. I look over, you know, with CJ, try to see where he's going to start the song, at least be on the right chord to start it, and then try to figure it out from there. You know?
That's great.
Yeah, your mind will start wandering and start thinking about other things or something, or looking at the audience, and, you know? You know, the songs come up so quick, you know?
Yeah, right.
And we don't. I try not to ever use a list or a song list, and I just, you know, just remember it all, you know.
Well, at least you think you do.
Yeah.
So you're gonna tour again for this new album, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You're gonna do America, of course, right?
Yeah.
Good. Well, I hope you do San Diego. I mean, if this is gonna be your last album, are you gonna like announce it as like a farewell tour kind of thing, or?
I don't know. I don't know what we're gonna do. I'd like to do that. I'm getting some people that think something different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to weigh out what people think here and take it from there.
Yeah, right.
I don't want it to become something depressing, though. You know, that you say the final tour or something.
Yeah, but if you do it as a, you know, going out with a bang, you know.
That's how I feel about it. I feel it should be announced as a final tour. But you see, when we play. The album comes out, say the album comes out in May, and we go out and play. That might not be the final tour at that point.
Yeah.
This would be the final album, but the final tour, we can still do another tour.
Yeah.
You know? So we could still play for anything from a year to two more years. Just depends, you know. I'll see how it's going along.
Right.
You know. But some countries will announce, like, I would think I'd like to announce a final tour. But, so when's the next issue coming out?
Well, I'm going to try to get it out in the next 3 or 4 months. It takes a wee while to get it together.
I can imagine. So you've never done an article on The Vagrants, then?
What's that?
You never done an article on The Vagrants?
No, I haven't. You know, this
whole... You never spoke to people who have seen them?
No, you're the first person I spoke to that's even seen them.
But you've heard a lot about them.
Oh, yeah. You know, I got the reissue of the album.
Right, I did too.
And, yeah.
No, you must have seen them, dozens of times.
Yeah, they were exceptional. They're really good.
Yeah.
It's one of those bands where, you know, I've always thought I'd have to do an article on those guys.
It's hard to tell that record, though, because I don't think anything really captured them at their best.
Yeah.
And the pictures are very, very early, too. It's pretty much a picture from the time of the single that I Can't Make a Friend while they're still in high school.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, they still look so cool in the picture, though.
They get really, they get different looking later, you know.
Now, the other thing I was going to ask you about is it would be cool if you got any old pictures of you. I don't know if you got any pictures of, like, you know, the Tangerine Puppets or you in high school or something like that. I think it would be cool to have a picture like that in the article. You know, I mean, something that no one's seen before, you know. Do you have anything like that?
I don't know. I was never big on taking photos. It always felt very silly taking a picture. You know, I'd look at my parents and I'd say, don't you have any pictures of me when I was a kid? And they always gave us a hard time when I took a picture, you know. You know, I still hate it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm stupid standing there.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Well, I don't know. If you can find something, I just think that would be, you know, something.
Did you get enough stuff?
Yeah. I kind
You're of, okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So, I really appreciate
your
time.
I'll get back to you just in case you think of anything else you want to go over.
Okay, yeah, that'd be cool.
You know?
Yeah, call me anytime, you know?
Yeah, okay, I'll get back to you next week sometime, just in case there's anything else you want to go over after you cipher through the notes.
Yeah, right.
You know, because we're just jumping all over the place.
And I can always get a hold of you at your mailbox and everything anyway.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure.
So,
but I'll give you a call next week anyway, then.
All right, man, we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, magazine's great.
Well, thanks.
You know, it's so detailed.
Yeah, maybe too detailed. I don't know.
It's just really detailed. I wish I could find film magazines on horror stuff that was like that.
All right, then.
Yeah, take care, Mike, and good talking to you, and I'll check back with you in a week or so, see if there's anything else that you, when you ever get ciphered through everything.
All right.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks a lot for everything.
Yeah, sure. Take care.
All right, bye.
Ugly Things podcast was produced by James Archer and hosted by Mike Stacks. That's me. Ugly Things magazine is available at the very coolest record and bookstores and at uglythings.com. That's ugly-things.com, where you can also order back issues, vinyl, books and CDs, and read additional articles and reviews. Please subscribe to the podcast, rate us, leave a review, and spread the word to your friends. I'd like to send out a personal thank you to our top Patreon supporters: Charlie Koenigsacker, Keith Patterson, Sophia Swartz, Dean Curtis, David Biasotti, David Jones, Michael Barbera, Chip Lyon, Rob Brannigan, Stephen Schmidt, J. Paul Reiger, and Derek Davidson. Thank you, all of you, for your support, and thank you for listening.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.